In case you haven't been here recently, we watched a DVD for a couple of weeks that put before us some of the questions surrounding the location of Mount Sinai, the place of the crossing of the sea. And we've considered some of these things, and I'll be referring back to the things that we learned on that DVD time or two over the next few weeks. So it's good to be back. We're actually going to pick up today where we left off the last time I taught. We'll be completing chapter 13 of Exodus, beginning with verse 17. Then we'll make a quick little foray over into Numbers chapter 9 toward the end of the lesson. The title today of the lesson is The Pillar of Cloud and Fire. One of the current debates in biblical studies is the extent to which Jesus can be found in the Old Testament. In my opinion, far too often, scholars draw too broad a line between the Old Testament stories that we've been studying and the New Testament, where we have the full revelation of Jesus Christ. And in so doing, they do not heed the very words of Jesus himself, who said in John 5, verse 46, "If you had believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me." To me, that is a definitive basis for understanding the solution to this debate. It's natural for us to approach the interpretation of the New Testament by looking back at the Old Testament at stories and events that inform us of the history and the background of the New Testament passage we're attempting to understand. And in doing this, we're looking to comprehend the new revelation of the New Testament in light of what came before it. And this is absolutely proper. This is something we must do. But if we take the words of Jesus seriously, we understand that we must also interpret the Old Testament in light of the New Testament. It's absolutely proper to read the Old Testament from the perspective of a New Testament Christian and to see in the Old Testament the person and work of Jesus. For the two testaments are not at odds with one another. They're telling the same story. What we've seen so far in our study of Exodus is the working out of God's plan to deliver his people from the bondage of Egypt and the beginning of Israel's migration from Egypt to the homeland that God had promised years earlier to the patriarch Abraham. We've seen that God called Moses to play a very important role in this plan, in the plan to deliver Israel from the bondage of Egypt to the freedom of the promised land. This bondage was real history. But in another sense, when we read about the bondage of Israel, we must understand that it is illustrative of every man's natural state, which can be described and which is described, in fact, in the Bible as the bondage of sin and death. We've seen that God appeared to Moses in the form of a burning fire. It was a fire that engulfed a bush but did not consume the bush. And from that manifestation of himself, God called Moses to serve him. And we've seen that as part of God's revelation of his character and of his nature to Moses, and through Moses to Israel and through Israel to us, that God took that name Yahweh, which was known by Abraham, and he expanded its meaning so that we've come to understand more about the nature of God, that he is a God who blesses those whom he has chosen to bear his name, and he judges those who oppose him. Through the 10 plagues, God brought this very judgment against Egypt. Through the plagues, God dismantled the power centers of Egypt, the most powerful nation on earth. And soon he will complete the destruction of Egypt's army at the Red Sea. Finally, there are two very important theological lessons that have been taught to Israel and therefore to us as well. They've been taught through the initiation and the celebration of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, And in this annual celebration of the Passover, it was designed in such a way that future generations of Jews, specifically those Jews who were not alive at the time of the Exodus event itself, could participate in the Exodus by recreating the Exodus, at least symbolically, every time the Passover is celebrated. And of supreme importance to Israel as well as to the church is the lesson that the remission of sins is accomplished only through the shedding of blood. In Israel, the Passover lamb died so that the penalty of Israel's sins was not laid on the people, for God had chosen to redeem them. And we learned in our study of the Passover that this Old Testament image of the lamb pointed forward to the atonement of Christ that he accomplished for us on Calvary. Today we pick up our study in verse 17 of chapter 13. So let's begin by reading Exodus chapter 13, verses 17 through 22. Now it came about when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was nearer. For God said the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people instead around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear. That is, Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God shall surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones from here with you. Then they set out from Succoth, and they camped in Etham on the edge of the wilderness. The Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on their way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. What most people think that the time that they traveled was typically in the early morning when it was cool. Then perhaps they rested during the heat of the day and then traveled again in the evening hours. The chapter closes with verse 22. Regarding this pillar, he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. These verses describe again Israel's departure from Egypt. In fact, verse 17 of chapter 13 picks up where verse 37 of chapter 12 left off. In between 12:37 and 13:17, we studied two liturgical appendices that dealt with the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the law of the firstborn. But by the time we get to verse 17 now, our attention is being drawn back to the event of the Exodus itself. And I think I'd like to read those two verses together so you can see how the flow and the continuity of this section flows so well. If you look back at 12:37, it reads this way. Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot besides the children. And now 13:17. Now it came about when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by the land of the Philistines, even though it was near. For God said the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. In the phrase, and it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go, we see that Moses, in writing this, is resetting the stage after this liturgic interlude. There's also a reference in verse 20 of chapter 13 to Succoth, which echoes back to that verse we read in chapter 12, verse 37. And further, as we get to this point in the story, we begin to notice that the great events of the Exodus are initiated and orchestrated by God himself, not by Moses, not by the Israelites. If you know the story of Moses at all, you understand that Moses was not a man who saw a terrible injustice being committed against Israel and decided on his own to leave his happy life in Midian at the age of 80, I might add, to travel with his wife two infant sons and a couple of donkeys to Egypt, where he would overthrow the most powerful government on the face of the earth at that time. No man is that foolish. Moses was an instrument that God used, but the initiative for the Exodus and for this redemption lies with God alone. We see this in verse 17. Notice the phrase, God did not lead them. Then in verse 18, hence God led them. Verse 21, it is the Lord who is going before them, leading them. If we can continue to consider verse 17, we see that the latter half of the verse explains to the reader, both to future generations of to Jews and to us, something about the route that Israel took out of Egypt. There were three major transportation routes between North Africa and the Middle East, that is, between Egypt and Canaan and Saudi Arabia. This is a map of the Sinai Peninsula. I hope you can see. This is Egypt. They would have left here from this area, come to Sukkot. We're pretty certain about that location. The first route that I want you to be aware of is a route that would have come up right along the edge of the Mediterranean Sea and would have come into Canaan in this way. It would have run right along the coastline to the north. This particular route was called the Via Mare, the Way of the Sea. It was a military highway that was used by the Egyptian army to move troops back and forth between Egypt and the Middle East. Military installations and fortresses dotted that entire roadway. If Israel were trying to avoid the Egyptians, which I think is a reasonable assumption, this route would have been her last choice because they would have immediately been confronted by the Egyptian army from whom they were trying to get away. Now, there was another route, and I'm not going to walk over there because it runs almost identically from the area in Egypt up into Canaan, but it runs slightly south of route number one. Same direction, same basic destination, but it is somewhat south of that route that I traced for you. It traversed what the Bible calls the land of the Philistines, an area of potential danger for the Israelites. Now, these Philistines that are mentioned here in Exodus are not the sea peoples that we know as the Philistines that inhabited the northwest coast of Canaan in the 12th century B.C. They may have been predecessors to the Philistines, but they were not those same peoples. This particular group of Philistines, or predecessors of Philistines, lived southwest of Beersheba in what is known as the Negev Desert. And that was the final destination of Route 2. Route 3 started at the same place, but it came down to the south across the Sinai here, and its destination was the northern end of the Gulf of Aqaba. So it ran east-southeast. And again, when we speak of the Red Sea, we're speaking of the Gulf of Suez, which is the left arm of, or the western arm of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the right or the eastern arm of the Red Sea, and they both flow into a much larger body of water, which would extend down to the floor if we were seeing this whole thing with the Sinai Peninsula here, Egypt here, and Canaan up here. So this third route would have come in this direction. Verse 18 tells us that it was that third route that God chose for Israel. As I said, the text of the Bible doesn't ever really refer to Route 1. It does refer to Route 2. But it states that God did not lead them around Route 2 for fear that they would encounter these Philistines as they got up the road, find themselves in a war, and be demoralized by that. And then we find an interesting phrase there. It said God did not take them along through the route that goes through the land of the Philistines, even though it was nearer. Now that's an interesting phrase. God did not take them along route number 2, even though it was nearer. What can we learn from that phrase, even though it were nearer? I think what this teaches us about ourselves from a theological point of view is that human viewpoint alone cannot be trusted to bring us to the right conclusions. I'm saying that there's an axiom in Euclidean geometry, which as a mathematician you well know, that says that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. The logical conclusion here, if you were going to travel from Egypt to Canaan, would be perhaps, well, I don't want to go along the Via Mare because I don't want to run into the Egyptian army every few miles. But Route 2 takes me in pretty much the same place, and it's one of the shorter ways to get from Egypt to Canaan. It's the obvious choice. Initially, at least, it's safer because the army isn't going to confront them, and it was closer. It was the shortest distance between Egypt and Canaan that they could realistically take. But God knew that if Israel followed on that road, they would eventually encounter something for which they were not prepared, this Philistine area. He knew that they would arrive in the Promised Land too soon. In fact, this is exactly what we see happened over in Numbers 14 when Moses sent out spies to spy out the land of Canaan. And they came back and they made a report to Moses. They said, there are giants in the land. What was Israel's response to that report? Well, Numbers 14 says they responded this way. Let's choose a leader, not Moses, anyone but Moses. Let's choose a leader and let us return to Egypt. That's the very thing that God is trying to avoid by not taking them this way. So for these reasons and for some reasons that will become clear probably next week, God sent Israel along the southern route in the wrong direction. They were led through the wilderness to a place called Yam Suf. Our English Bibles translate that the Red Sea, and I'll talk about this more next week. But I've written Yam Suf up here. If you translate this literally, it means the Sea of Reeds. The word Yam is the Hebrew word for sea. Suf means reed or marshes. Most commentators identify Yam Suf as the shallow lakes north of the Gulf of Suez. If you read almost any book, I know you can't see very well over here, there are some lakes up here. Some of them are dry, some of them are still there, some are no longer there because of the Suez Canal. But this particular time, there were lakes that were up here. And if you look at almost any traditional route of the Exodus, probably can find it in the backs of your Bibles, you're going to see Israel leaving here and traversing one of these little lakes. That's what you're going to see. Well, there are some reasons for this. First, the word Suf, as I've mentioned, means marsh or reeds, which would be a pretty good description of the lakes up in the north region of Egypt, because that's where the Nile Delta was. Any contribution by liberal critics to this conversation, to me, are pretty well moot, because they don't believe there was a crossing in the first place, so they're really not serious about trying to locate where this event occurred. Moderately liberal commentators are typically looking for a natural explanation for how this event occurred. So the more shallow the lake, the better they feel about it. It's like, well, I don't have quite as big a problem if the lake's 5 feet deep. Of course, I'm not sure how you drown an Egyptian army in 5 feet of water. The likelihood is that Israel traversed, the likelihood that they would come far enough south, they would not have come from where they lived far enough south and crossed the Gulf of Suez. That makes absolutely no sense. So where is this place called Yam Suf? Well, in 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 26, guess where Yam Suf is? I will read that in a minute. It's the Gulf of Aqaba. And I'm going to refer to a city in a moment that occurs right here at the tip of the Gulf. And you'll notice in the verse mention of the word Edom. So where is Yam Suf? 1 Kings 9, verse 26. King Solomon also built a fleet of ships in Ezion-Geber, which is located at the top of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is near Elot, on the shore of Yam Suf in the land of Edom. Where is Yam Suf? This is it, the Gulf of Aqaba. Here's Israel. Solomon's navy was right here, Yam Suf. Everyone comfortable with that as an identification from 1 Kings. The mention of Ezion-Geber, which is one thing we can pinpoint pretty closely, which is the top of the Gulf of Aqaba, and the reference to the land of Edom in 1 Kings 9 convinces me that the use of Yam Suf in the Old Testament refers to the Gulf of Aqaba. By the way, the term Red Sea, and I will talk about this later, comes from the Septuagint, not from the Masoretic text. Now, there's some interesting translations of the latter half of verse 18. Here the Bible's describing how Israel left Egypt. My translation, the NASB, says that Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. The NIV reads that the Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle. I'm not sure about the King James, but I think it says something like harnessed. The term that's used there is this word Hamas. Not Hamas, but Hamash. It's a really hard term to translate. About the best anyone can do is to tell you that it means take five, and that's not the name of a Dave Brubeck song, for those of you who are jazz aficionados. One thing I think is certain is that it's unlikely that Israel would have been transformed overnight from a generation of slaves to a well-equipped army. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense for me. I think what this is saying is that they walked five abreast. And the point is that when Israel left Egypt, they left in an orderly fashion, not like a mob of slaves running from the Egyptians. Verse 19, they even took with them the remains of Joseph. You'll remember when we studied Joseph, he was embalmed in the land of Egypt. And he was embalmed after he had elicited a solemn oath from his descendants that when God came and visited them in a way that would bring deliverance to Israel, that his descendants would promise that they would take his remains back with them to the land of Israel and bury him there. What's interesting is if you look at Stephen's sermon in Acts chapter 7, specifically in verses 15 and 16, it may indicate that they brought the bones of Joseph and the bones of his brothers back to Canaan, though it's not stated so explicitly in the Old Testament. In Acts 7:16, the Greek text reads that they were removed to Shechem and buried, where the word they may very well refer to the brothers and not to Joseph's bones. So it may be that they brought the whole family. That we don't know for sure. We do know from verse 20 that they set out from Sukkot and they camped at Etham, which the text tells us is located on the edge of the wilderness. Now Sukkot, we know, is up in the Nile Delta in Egypt. We're not really sure where Etham is. In fact, there are several place names that are mentioned here and then in the beginning of chapter 14, which are a bit elusive. We have the reference to Etham. We have the mention of a place called Pi-Hahiroth, which means mouth of the gorges. There's a place called Migdal, which means tower. And there's a place called Baal-Zephon, which literally means Lord of the North, which is said to have been by the sea, which I will presume is the Gulf of Aqaba. When you look for these places on the maps, the first thing is most people assume they're cities. And they may have all been cities, or some of them may have been cities, but I'm not sure they were. When you look on a map, and if you take, for example, Accordance, which is one of the better software programs now for biblical studies, if you were in Harold's class, you've seen him bring Accordance to class and show you things from that on his computer. If you look up these cities in Accordance, they all appear on the map up here in the northwest corner of the Sinai, but they appear with question marks next to them. And if you look in Bible atlases or perhaps in the backs of some of your Bibles, sometimes you're going to see those places listed, but many times they're going to be listed with a question mark. Let me tell you why. Scholars don't really know where these places were with any certainty. In fact, let me let you in on a little secret. Don't tell anybody. Scholars don't know as much as they would like you to think they do. For example, Etham. It's said to be on the edge of the wilderness. If we assume the wilderness is the Sinai Peninsula, the edge of the wilderness could mean the western edge of the wilderness, or it could mean the eastern edge of the wilderness. It doesn't say. Numbers 33 complicates matters. Don't turn there. But I'll tell you that verse 6 of Numbers 33 says, they journeyed from Sukkot and they camped in Etham on the edge of the desert. Verse 7 says, they journeyed from Etham and they turned back to Pi-hahiroth, the mouth of the gorges, which faces Baal-zephon, and they camped before Migdal, which may just mean a tower. And here's where it gets interesting. Verse 8. They passed through the sea. Okay, so here's the Red Sea crossing. They passed through the sea into the wilderness, presumably another wilderness that's on the east side of the sea, because they would have traveled from west to east. Then they traveled 3 days in the wilderness of Etham. So they left Etham, crossed the sea, and then traveled in Etham. How's that possible? Well, if it's a city, it's probably not possible. But it very well may be that Etham was a region which ran north and south on the west side of the Gulf of Aqaba, around the point, and then down on the eastern side as well. If that's the case, they were camped at Etham, crossed the sea into the other side of the region of Etham, and traveled there for a period of 3 days. Here's the point that's important. That's interesting. But what's important about this? This is, wherever they were not alone. God was with them, and he manifested himself and his presence to them in an interesting form. The Bible says that he appeared as a pillar of cloud by day. By the way, a cloud is a common Old Testament representation for God's presence among his people. God manifested himself as a pillar of cloud by day and as a pillar of fire by night to give them light. The pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, and I presume, by the way, that this is the same pillar, not two different pillars, but a pillar which in the daytime manifested itself as a cloud, and then that same pillar gave light to them in the evening. This pillar of cloud and fire, it's a very appropriate symbol for God's presence among his people. Why is a cloud a good way of manifesting God to his people? Because it metaphorically hides the face of God from Israel, thus preserving the lives of the Israelites. For Moses says over in Exodus 33:20, no man can look at the face of God and live. If that's true, and we assume, of course, that it is, then God shrouds his glory in the cloud to preserve the lives of his people. Now, the fire is a little more tricky. I believe the fire in the cloud is nothing less than the Shekinah glory. Now, that's a term you should become familiar with. I've actually mentioned it before. It's a term that does not appear in the Old Testament, but it appears in many Hebrew documents, many Jewish writings, in the Talmud and in other rabbinical documents where these educated Jews were referring to God's presence among his people. The Shekinah glory encompasses the idea of God's abiding presence with Israel. It comes from a Hebrew verb called shaken, which means to dwell or abide or settle. The Shekinah was usually associated with fire, and light. It was the Shekinah that rested on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant in the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle. I believe it was the Shekinah glory that led the Magi to Bethlehem, the birth of Jesus. It's called a star in the New Testament. It was the Shekinah glory which burned in the bush, first seen by Moses on Mount Horeb. And it was the Shekinah shrouded by cloud that gave light to the Israelites in the pillar so they could travel by night. When you read about the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, it is God's presence among his people. The cloud is protecting the people from the face of God so they can live. The fire is the Shekinah that appears throughout the Old Testament and even into the New Testament as God manifesting himself among his people. Notice something about verse 22. It says, he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. God remained faithful to Israel, even when Israel was unfaithful to God. Just real quickly, I want to flip over to Numbers chapter 9, take a look at another few verses there that pertain to this same topic. It's a passage that deals with the subject of these pillars. Let me read for you Numbers chapter 9, verses 15 through 23. Now on the day that the tabernacle was erected, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, and in the evening it was like the appearance of fire. Notice it says the appearance of fire. It never says it was actual fire. It was like the appearance of fire over the tabernacle until morning. So it was that continuously the cloud would cover it by day and the appearance of fire by night. Whenever the cloud was lifted from over the tent, afterwards the son of Israel would then set out. And in the place where the cloud settled down, there the sons of Israel would camp. At the command of the Lord, the sons of Israel would set out, and at the command of the Lord, they would camp. As long as the cloud settled over the tabernacle, they remained camped. Even when the cloud lingered over the tabernacle for many days, the sons of Israel would keep the Lord's charge and not set out. If sometimes the cloud remained a few days over the tabernacle, according to the command of the Lord, they remained camped. Then according to the command of the Lord, they set out. If sometimes the cloud remained from evening until morning, when the cloud was lifted in the morning, they would move out. Or if it remained in the daytime and at night, whenever the cloud was lifted, they would set out. Whether it was 2 days or a month or a year that the cloud lingered over the tabernacle, staying above it, the sons of Israel remained camped and did not set out. But when it was lifted, they did set out. At the command of the Lord, they camped. And at the command of the Lord, they set out. They kept the Lord's charge according to the command of the Lord through Moses. Did you notice the number of times the phrase at the command of the Lord or at Lord's charge occurred in this passage? It occurred 9 times. The Lord's calling the shots here. The initiative is his. If Exodus 13 records the gift of the pillar, Numbers 9 records the law of the pillar. Now, the law of the pillar, I hope you can tell when I'm being facetious, is very complicated. I'm going to try to walk you through this. I want you to really, if you're sleepy, try to wake up a minute and follow me, because this is very difficult. There are 3 manifestations of this law here. Law number 1, when the pillar moved, Israel moved. That's really deep theology, isn't it? Don't worry, it gets more complicated. Law number 2, when the pillar stayed still, Israel stayed still. Here's the really complicated one. Law number 3. Israel stayed as long as the pillar stayed, and they moved as long as the pillar moved. I can't read this without remembering the day that I was called by the United States Army to take a physical to see if I were healthy enough to serve in the armed services. Let me set the stage for you. The guys in here are already smiling. I and approximately 50 other young men were put in a room where our clothes were taken away from us. All of them. If you think dealing with TSA at the airport is a challenge, we were each given a small green bag with a string tied around one end that we hung around our necks. This is where we put our valuables, which in those days, for me, didn't require a very large bag. Here's the important point. Next, we were told to follow the feet. Follow the feet. I looked down at the floor, and there were yellow feet painted on the floor. They were bare feet, not feet as might be depicted in shoes. I'm supposing they thought some of us might get confused when we didn't quite match up. We spent the next couple of hours walking, clad only in the green bag, around a maze of rooms and halls where one despicable thing was exceeded only by the next despicable thing. It's a memory that stayed with me throughout my life, especially the part about the painted feet. There was very little question about what to do next. Do you ever wish you had a little pillar of cloud and fire to tell you what to do next? Wouldn't it be nice if God would paint little feet on the floor so we would know exactly what He wanted us to do, where He wanted us to go, and when He wanted us to leave, and when He wanted us to stay? If we had that, if we had what Israel had, we'd never be disobedient, would we? We'd always make the right decision. I'm absolutely certain of that. But what happened when Moses went up the mountain for 40 days to get the law? Was Israel obedient? They had the pillar. Were they faithful? No. Israel built and worshipped a golden calf under the shadow of the pillar of cloud and fire. See, the problem is not that we don't have a pillar of cloud and fire. The problem is that at the center of our being, we're in rebellion against God. Every one of us. But even though we are by nature in a state of rebellion, the fact is, we have something better. God is giving us something better than the pillar of cloud and fire. Unlike Israel, we have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. And we have the Scriptures, the God-breathed Word of God that is inspired by God Himself, that is more profitable for us than a cloud or a pillar. The Scriptures are able to teach us, to offer reproof and correction when necessary, and through the Scriptures we receive training in righteousness. And it's through the Spirit who indwells us and by the Scriptures that inform us and instruct us and correct us that we are to live according to the admonishment of Habakkuk, the just shall live by faith. You see, there's a theological trap. The trap tells us that we are indeed saved by grace through faith, but that we live the Christian life by good works. The reality is we are saved by grace through faith, and we are to live the Christian life by grace through faith. When by God's commandment the cloud was lifted, Israel followed the cloud in obedience. But when by God's command the cloud remained, Israel rested in grace. Paul tells us in Galatians 5:16, "Walk by the Spirit, and you will not fulfill the desires of the flesh." And in Galatians 5:25, "If we live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit." God has given us, as New Testament Christians, a greater gift than He gave Israel. Israel experienced God's presence through a physical cloud. We've been given the third person of the Trinity to dwell in us. In a very real sense, the Shekinah glory is no longer out there. It's in here. That's Exodus 13. You're going to find when we get to the crisis at the Red Sea that the cloud moves from in front of them, where it had been, behind them, but and separates them from the Egyptian army. And the pillar, the single pillar, gave light to Israel through the night, but darkness to the Egyptians, which echoes back to that plague of darkness where it said that in the houses, you remember when we studied that plague, in the house and area of Goshen they had light, but in the areas of Egypt it was a darkness that could be felt. Remember the parable of the rich man and Lazarus? We tend to think that people don't believe in the Lord because there's not sufficient evidence or because there's evidence that you should believe some other way. But in that parable, we're taught a very interesting lesson. The rich man dies and goes to Hades. Abraham, not the patriarch, but the poor man goes to the bosom of Abraham, paradise. The rich man in the flames being tormented says, "Send someone from there back to my brothers so that they will believe and not come here." What did God say? "Though one rise from the dead, they won't believe." Isn't that exactly what happened? Jesus rose from the dead, and the world doesn't believe. So you can present evidence, but without the miraculous work of the Holy Spirit, man will not respond to evidence.